morning and welcome to the first hour of Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm John Raby, sitting in for Catherine Lanfer. With the discovery of the wreck of John Kennedy's plane in the waters off Martha's Vineyard, investigators stand a better chance of figuring out what went wrong Friday night when Kennedy was just 30 miles from his destination. In fact, dozens of things could have gone wrong on that flight, or on any flight of a small plane. It's the primary job of a pilot to anticipate what things could go wrong and to take steps to prevent them from happening or to minimize their impact. And despite what you might think or might have heard since the crash last weekend, accidents in small planes, known as general aviation as compared to big commercial planes, accidents in these planes have been decreasing even as the number of pilots and hours flown has increased markedly. In this hour of Mid-Morning, we're talking small plane safety with one of the experts in the field. He's Ken Eibold, the editor of Aviation Safety, a monthly newsletter. Mr. Eibold, thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning, John. Glad to be here.
Our numbers, if you have questions for Mr. Eibold or comments to make, 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828, our toll-free line. And let me ask you first, Mr. Eibold, since they found the plane, what answers could the wreckage give us about what happened on that flight? What evidence might there be in, you know, in the fuselage?
There may be some evidence if there were some sort of mechanical malfunction, catastrophic propeller failure. Those indications may or may not exist in the wreckage. In addition, the shape of the condition of the propeller, for example, will tell if the engine was producing a lot of power at the time of impact or not. But, you know, given the descent profile that radar appears to show, you know, that point appears to be moot, it looks like it probably was under power as it was descending.
Mm-hmm. So the question there would be whether the engine was working or whether it conked out, which is a concern in small planes.
Well, yes and no. The fact that the descent was so rapid indicates to me that the engine was probably still producing power.
Mm-hmm.
There are other more subtle cues that may or may not have survived both the impact and the submersion in salt water for several days. And just as kind of some examples, from markings on the airspeed indicator, they'll be able to tell how fast the airplane was traveling at the time it struck. They can tell through microscopic analysis if certain warning lights were illuminated at the time, things like that. It's very delicate kind of evidence, and given the corrosive environment that they've been sitting in, it may or may not have survived.
Sure. One question that, and I'll just ask it, but my guess is it's out of your range of expertise. Will they examine the body of JFK Jr. for any evidence that might indicate what happened in the flight?
Well, it is standard procedure in a fatal accident to conduct certain toxicological tests.
Mm-hmm.
For example, checking for drugs and alcohol, not only illegal drugs, but also some prescription drugs that are not approved for flight. They can check for things like carbon monoxide poisoning.
Which is a concern in small planes, too.
Well, it is because the aircraft heater operates off of the muffler system, and if that's cracked or something, then the exhaust can work its way into the cabin.
Yeah.
Those tests, at this point, I'm not a medical expert. They may or may not yield evidence given the length of time that's elapsed.
Sure, and I should be clear here that we're not insinuating anything about drinking of drugs or anything. This is just SOP for crash victims.
Yes, it is.
What are your concerns of the media coverage and analysis of the crash, focusing for you on the aviation aspects?
Well, you know, I never really thought that the terms like VFR and spatial disorientation would become part of the popular lexicon, but as I have reviewed the media coverage for the last few days, I have noticed that there seems to be a lot of attention to this accident as if it were something that was totally out of the ordinary. In fact, as far as aviation accidents go, this was a fairly typical one. The whole question of an unqualified pilot flying into poor visibility, I don't want to say it happens routinely, but it's certainly not unheard of. It happens, you know, possibly once or twice a month on average, a little bit more during bad weather, and during the summer it's a little less common. But, you know, this is something that pilots are trained from almost from their initial lesson to avoid until they have an instrument rating.
So this the coverage you're saying painted this as a unique or you know, less common kind of accident, when in fact it's something that the pilots deal with all the time.
Well, it was uncommon in the fact that it was piloted by someone of you know, Mr. Kennedy's fame.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate reality is that small airplane accidents do happen. Although I think all pilots and all instructors and the FAA have been working successfully to minimize them. But when you have something like Mr. Kennedy's crash, or you know, John Denver's crash, or Thurman Munson, you can cite a few others. You know, it does focus some a lot of attention on the industry and the fact that most people are really unfamiliar with the dynamics of light planes. Leads them to conclude, therefore, that light planes are about to drop out of the sky at any moment. But in fact, there are hundreds of thousands of light aircraft flying. You know, there are tens of thousands of flights every day. And, you know, I think that the safety record, although it can improve, is really not that bad.
You said there was exaggeration. Was there unreasonable speculation in the coverage?
Well, I think any time you run into something like this, the competitiveness of most media outlets fuels that speculation wildly. In this particular case, especially over the weekend, I think a lot of the speculation was tinted with downright inaccuracies and ignorance. And you know, that was, for me, that was extremely frustrating because, you know, I think given the fact that it was a weekend, it was difficult for reporters to get hold of, you know, people that they otherwise would have contacted. You know, lacking an authoritative interpretation of the events, they settled for whatever they could get.
Give me an example.
Well, I noticed that, you know, just about any, you know, local CFI, certified flight instructor, would you know, end up on the news, or even, you know, people who were just, you know, your basic private pilot would be interviewed on the news saying, gee, what happened? When certainly they were not qualified to answer that in anything other than the most vague terms.
Mm. Also, the speculation about his broken ankle and
yes.
How that might have, people were saying it was irresponsible for him to fly with a broken ankle. Is that true?
Well, that's been one of my pet peeves. Yes, it is true that you need your feet to fly an airplane.
Controls the rudder, right?
It controls the rudder, and it also controls steering on the ground. However, I have significant experience in a Saratoga, and I can tell you that if he could steer that thing on the ground, he could certainly steer it on the air. In the air, the pressures involved in turning the thing on the ground is very nose wheel heavy in steering when it's on the ground. And you don't quite have to stand up on the rudder pedals, but almost. And certainly in flight, it's more of a delicate pressure using your ankles, and it's nowhere near what it takes on the ground. So, you know, for that reason, I think that the significance that people were trying to attach to his leg injury was misplaced.
Sure. 15 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we're working through some of the possibilities in the JFK Jr. plane crash on Friday night. In case you haven't heard, they have found the wreckage, and they have found at least the body of John F. Kennedy Jr. in the waters off Martha's Vineyard. We'll be bringing you updates on this throughout the day. If you'd like to call with questions for our guest, Ken Eibold of Aviation Safety, here are the numbers. 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. or 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. I wanted to talk about the pilot training, private pilot training. There are a couple different levels, and there are a lot of different nuances, and it means different things. So can we start first with the two levels of training? You've got VFR, which is basically visual, and then you have instrument certification, right? Can you explain the differences in training and what it means for a pilot skill level?
Yes, the primary instruction that is for a private pilot license. There is a sub license called a recreational license that is not really very popular. I think we can exclude that from our discussion. Mm-hmm. But for your basic private pilot license, it requires a minimum of 40 hours of training, some of which is dual, some of which is solo, some of which involves trips at least 50 miles from your origination point. You learn to maneuver the airplane. You learn the rudimentary navigation. You learn a little bit about aerodynamics, and you start to develop the skills for moving the airplane through the air. You have to remember that the air is moving over the ground as well as the airplane moving through the air. So you have to learn, similar to driving a boat in a river where there's a current, you have to learn to compensate for that.
Sure, another dimension in there.
Yes.
That's 40 hours of flying time you need?
That's 40 hours of time is the regulatory minimum.
Okay.
In fact, it takes most people somewhere on the order of 70 to 75 hours to complete the training.
Okay, so just doing your 40 hours doesn't do it. You have to have an instructor certify you.
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, what you do is you also have to take a written test, mm-hmm. that will test your knowledge of regulations, a little bit on weather, a little bit on aerodynamics, a little bit on airplane performance.
And this is what's called VFR, and that's flying without instruments.
That's called visual flight rules.
Yeah.
It is the pilot's responsibility to maintain his own separation from the ground, from other airplanes, to navigate. The VFR pilot does not have to speak to air traffic controllers except in certain airspace, primarily around busy airports. And the onus of safety is clearly on the pilot's shoulders with VFR flight. At the end of their training, of course, they have to take a flight test through a federally an FAA-designated pilot examiner who will put them through their paces and see if they, in fact, know how to pilot an airplane, and if they're successful, they get their license. Building on that is what is called an instrument rating, which is an addition to the private certificate, the private license. Now, the instrument rating includes additional training of flight by reference to the instruments alone, and while doing that, you wear a view limiting device that there are a couple different kinds out there. The most popular one looks like sort of like a baseball cap that has a very long bill
it's like blinders, basically.
That folds down on the sides. Another one is a pair of sunglasses.
But I'm sorry to focus this. The point is that if you're flying in a fog or flying in a haze like Kennedy was, you would look at your instruments only, and you should be able to fly the plane like by that. But that takes a certain amount of training. How many hours of training does that take, and why doesn't everybody get it?
Well, that depends. The number of hours it takes depends a lot on the how much flying experience the person has. The part of the country where they live, the type of airplane they're flying. It's kind of hard to put a handle on that, but I think it's safe to assume that it's going to take another, 50 to 60 hours of training.
Okay, and that's spendy, as we say here in Minnesota.
Yes, well, the private pilot license typically is going to cost you about $3,500 to $4,000, and the instrument rating is going to add a like amount to that.
Another $4,000.
So yes. Yes.
I'm kind of confused here because Kennedy was flying at night, and you're allowed to fly at night under with a VFR rating, with a VFR certificate, right? How can you do that? How can you fly in the dark without using your instruments?
Well, it's actually easier than you might think. When you're flying over any kind of populated area, you can see the cities, you can see the lights below. and that creates a horizon for you. If there's moonlight, if the moon is out, you can distinguish between the horizon that is ground and the sky. The problem comes when it's a dark night, the moon is small or non-existent, mm-hmm. And especially in the case typical of Mr. Kennedy's flight, he went out over water. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he was under control as he was flying over land, but when he turned out over water is when he started to run into problems. Because then you lose the ground references. And at that point, if you have no moonlight and you have no ground references, you might as well be flying on instruments because you have no other way to maintain yourself in an upright attitude.
Is it generally safe for VFR certified pilots to fly at night? Should there be restrictions on night flying?
There are some restrictions as far as recency of experience.
Mm-hmm. Meaning?
Well, you have to have flown at night in the past few months. You have to do a certain number of takeoffs and landings at night in order to carry passengers, and that's by federal regulation. The whole issue of safety of night flight is one that different countries disagree on. Many countries bar VFR flight at night by pilots who are not instrument rated. However, that tends to be, for example, Australia does, because there are so many places that are uninhabited where you're not going to get those ground light references. The U.S. does allow it. I think it's safe. There are some additional hazards. For example, you can't see clouds that you're going to fly into sometimes, and so you can find yourself in the clouds or in the fog or in the haze when you didn't really know it was there. That's certainly a hazard. But as far as the risk goes, a lot of it depends on, what you're trying to get your airplane to do. If you're in Arizona and, flying around the city to look at the lights, that's perfectly safe as a daytime flight. If you're, flying across open water when there's no moon, then, that's a different story.
Well, let's take some calls. My phone numbers are 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. I'll be talking with Ken Eibold, editor of Aviation Safety, and Dan is our first caller from Rochester. Hi, Dan.
Good morning, John.
Good morning. What's your question?
Ken, I'd like to get your opinion. I'm a private pilot. I have about 500 hours. And I found it very difficult to find an instructor that would actually teach spin recovery. They teach a lot of eminent spin recovery, but why are instructors so reluctant to actually teach full spin recovery?
I think there's a couple different possible reasons for that.
Can I stop you? Spin recovery, is that just what it sounds like? You dive and you get in a spin?
Well, a spin is, in a low-speed regime, the airplane will stall. That is, the airflow over the wings breaks down so that lift is lost.
Mm-hmm.
And if a recovery from a stall is not executed correctly, then you get into what's called a spin where you start, the nose plunges downward, the airplane kind of flips over to the side, one of the wings drops severely, and you start descending extremely rapidly with a rotating movement of the airplane.
Hmm.
It's a maneuver that is it's very common, for example, in air show flying. That's one of the staples. Spin training was required by the federal government for years until some statistician determined that more people were dying learning how to recover from spins than were actually dying from spins.
Hmm. So it's not a big... Well, how often will a plane go into a small plane go into a spin?
Well, there are a lot of scenarios for unintentional spins. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to really say how often it happens. But when it does happen, it's generally going to happen somewhere in the airport traffic pattern as the airplanes are close to the ground and maneuvering to land
and going slowly, like you
said. And they start turning, and that's where you start running into problems with spins.
Is this the same thing as the death spiral?
No, it's a different phenomenon. We can get into death spiral. Death spirals are graveyard spirals a little bit if you want to. But the whole question of spin training, to answer your question, is that a lot of instructors don't know how to do it. or, you know, they're required to demonstrate that it has been demonstrated to them in order to get their CFI rating, their instructor rating. But that doesn't mean they're comfortable with it. My suggestion for getting spin training, if you're interested, is to seek out an instructor who flies an aerobatic airplane.
Well, good luck with that, Dan. Let's go to John on the line from Minneapolis. John, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have just a couple of points to add to the discussion, not really questions per se. I'm a VFR-rated pilot and have been for a number of years. And one of the things that concerns me about the media coverage on these kinds of high-profile celebrity accidents in the air is that there's some statistics that that ought to help people understand that small planes are not really inherently dangerous any more than that cars are more dangerous than buses who are driven by professionals. And one of the statistics is that the number of hours flown in general aviation actually, and your guests can probably set me straight on the exact numbers, but the number of hours are actually the same or greater than those flown by commercially scheduled airlines. And the second point is that if you look at the kinds of accidents that occur, and there have been analyses by the government over the years, that you can account for over 90% of all of the different kinds of aircraft accidents by really two major factors. One is a VFR-rated pilot who continues flight into IFR conditions.
IFR is when you need instruments to fly.
Correct. Right. And the second kind of condition is some variation on running out of gas. And these two often go together. You know, a pilot gets himself into a circumstance where his plans have changed because of weather conditions or whatever, and he runs out of gas as he's trying to find an alternate landing site. But all of this comes down to the fact that, you know, the training of the pilots and their knowledge of their own limitations is absolutely key to safety. The last point I'd like to add is you were talking earlier about the commitment required to gain instrument rating. And it's really not just the training up front that you have to take into account. There are ongoing requirements for currency, especially if you want to carry passengers, which require a commitment for, you know, months and months during the year when you're going to be practicing and continuing to keep your skills sharp. Like anything else, if you go out of practice, they're basically the skills are lost to you.
Let me ask you two something, if I could.
Yeah.
Do you think that most pilots who are VFR certified, right, and I'm just talking about officially VFR certified, have a pretty good understanding of what the instruments mean? They just don't have the rating for it, so they can use them, but they just don't have the official stamp of approval on their license.
Speaking from my own experience, you know, I know what the attitude indicator and the rate of climb and all the rest of that means. But what's really tough to understand, and for the general public especially, is that when you're flying, your inner ear, which is what we use to stay upright when we're walking on the ground and so on, sends you all the wrong messages about what's happening to your aircraft. And you really need the extra practice and training to so that your mind can overcome what your body is telling you, and you believe those instruments and can then successfully not just fly the plane but navigate to where your destination is and land. And there's a study that was done back in the 40s, I believe, that showed that a competent visual pilot in absence of ground references and without the training to understand his instruments and rely on his instruments could only remain upright in a cloud, for example, for about 60 seconds. And so, like I say, your body fools you, and you really need the extra training so that you have the practice and the skills to rely on those instruments. Even though you know what they mean, you've got to fight the urge to go with what your body's telling you.
Yes, I agree with that. And one thing that I would like to add is that it is fairly easy to teach someone the physical coordination and maneuvers required to keep an airplane flying. What is more difficult, and an instrument rating helps refine that coordination. So, for example, while someone who is a VFR pilot may let their altitude wander a little bit or their heading wander a little bit, the requirements of instrument flight just tighten that tolerance a little bit. The additional training of an IFR pilot is in helping to make the judgment of when the weather is too bad to go or when the weather is sufficiently, you know, good, I guess you would say, to allow the flight to be made safely. And the whole question of judgment as I think we've mentioned, is that the vast majority of accidents are due to two prominent pilot errors, two bad calls that people make. You know, they run out of gas and they fly into weather they can't handle. And, you know, there's no regulation in the world that can prevent that.
Well, we're going to get a look at news in just a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you, should JFK Jr. have even taken off Friday night?
Well, that's easy for me to say yes or no to.
Mm-hmm.
The whole theory behind VFR flight is the pilot is the pilot in command. And that is a tradition that has held from the earliest days of aviation. And the private pilot training and instrument pilot training and all pilot training tells you that if you get into a weather pattern, for example, that you can't handle or that your aircraft can't handle, to turn around. And that is one thing that he should have done that he did not do. Now, should he have taken off? We can't say because, you know, although some other pilots who, you know, planned a flight in that area that night have said, you know, well, gee, that weather was too bad for me, and I didn't go. Well, that doesn't mean that you know, he couldn't go. But what he had to do was at some point realize, hey, I can't do this. This is over my head. I'm turning around and going back where I came from. And that is the ego call that sends a lot of pilots in the wrong direction.
9:33, you're listening to Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm John Raby. Our guest is Ken Eibold, editor of Aviation Safety, a monthly newsletter that keeps track of aviation. Our phone numbers are 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. And if you happen to have the New York Times, today's New York Times, go to page A17, and it gives a pretty good graphic about instruments that shows you how the instruments work on an airplane. You may want to check that out. In the meantime, let's get a check of news headlines from Greta Cunningham.
Thanks, John, and good morning. Divers are preparing to go down to the site where remote cameras discovered the remains of John F. Kennedy Jr. Search officials say their highest priority now is to locate the other victims. Kennedy, his wife Carolyn Bessette Kennedy, and her sister Lauren Bessette were all on board a Piper Saratoga aircraft en route to Martha's Vineyard when it plunged into the ocean Friday night. Officials say Kennedy's body was found during the night in about 100 feet of water. His body was found with what officials describe as a significant part of the wreckage of his plane. Members of the Kennedy family have been talking with a priest at a Manhattan church where Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis sometimes worshipped. The Reverend John Boning says no final decisions have been made, but he says he hopes to know more sometime today. President Clinton is holding his first news conference today in nearly a month. He's expected to talk about the Republicans' huge tax cut plan. The Federal Reserve has approved a special Y2K loan program. The package will give banks an extra cushion of cash just in case their customers start withdrawing lots of money because of the millennium bug. In regional news, Republican presidential hopeful George W. Bush is visiting Minnesota today and could add another $500,000 to his campaign fund. Bush will attend a private fundraiser today and will also visit a Minneapolis homeless shelter. Yesterday, Bush picked up the endorsement of first-term Minnesota Senator Rod Graham. Graham says Bush will provide the common-sense conservative leadership the nation needs. Bush has outpaced his GOP rivals by raising more than $37 million. Former Minnesota Senator Rudy Boschwitz is Bush's state finance chairman. He predicts today's fundraiser could bring in as much as $500,000. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of thunderstorms in the far south and southeast. Partly cloudy this afternoon in central, southern, and northern Minnesota. There's a chance of afternoon thunderstorms in the northeast today. It will be warm and humid statewide today with high temperatures near 85 to 92 degrees. Checking current conditions, Rochester reports light rain in 68. It's sunny in Duluth in 67, cloudy in Fargo in 68. And in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies, a temperature of 70 degrees. John, that's a look at the latest news.
Thank you very much, Minnesota Public Radio's Greta Cunningham. And Greta mentioned that George W. Bush is in town. Bush is calling himself a compassionate conservative. We're going to talk about that label from 10 to 11 on Mid-Morning. There's more Mid-Morning on small plane safety on the way.
It's time for a checkup. Hi, Gary Acton, inviting you to join us for Y2K Day here on Minnesota Public Radio as we find out whether the state, the nation, the world is ready for the new year. What happens to all those computers come January 1? What if they crash? We'll have live coverage of NPR's Y2K Summit at noon. Then at 7, live coverage from St. Paul of a community conversation with White House Advisor John Koskinen. Y2K Day here on Minnesota Public Radio, KNW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
It's 9:36. You're listening to Mid-Morning. Ken Eibold is our guest. He's editor of Aviation Safety. We're talking small plane safety, and we're taking your calls, too. We've got Mike on the line from Northfield. Hi, Mike. I guess we don't have Mike. Let's go to Joel instead from St. Paul. Hi, Joel. You're there, right?
Good morning, yes.
Great.
I have a question regarding the search and recovery effort, and from the coverage I've seen, it seems like there's half the Navy out there, and I'm wondering if I had flown my plane or landed my plane in those waters, if the effort would be made to find me.
Mr. Eibold, do you know?
Well, I think that the search effort would have been very, very significant up to the point where the rescuers concluded that water conditions would make survival impossible. There are a few ditchings at sea that every year that in which the bodies are never recovered and the aircraft is never recovered. In those cases, while there is the hope of finding somebody alive, I do think that the search would have been as significant, if not as publicized. Mm-hmm. Once it got to the point where they determined that nobody could have survived in that temperature water for that long, then at that point they would have collected the debris that they had, listed the pilot as presumed dead, and closed the file with that the aircraft was not recovered.
Yeah, I'm reading from the New York Times here. At the White House, a spokesman acknowledged the unusual nature of the effort that's underway. Jake Stewart said, "We're taking some reasonable measures beyond what we might normally do in this instance. In ordinary circumstances," again quoting the Times here, "the government does nothing to retrieve such wreckage. The FAA provides radar data to help find a wreck, and the Coast Guard will control marine traffic while private parties pay for salvage. Airplanes that crash, whether they're operated by private individuals, corporations, or airlines, are almost always salvaged by the insurance company that covered them." I would guess it's JFK Jr., and that's why the extraordinary effort is happening. Let's take another call. Let's go to Ed in Grand Rapids. Ed, thank you very much for calling up. Welcome to the show. Well, Ed's gone too. Let me ask you about death spirals, which is what they're saying was happening with JFK Jr.'s plane. What is that? How is it different from just the plain old spin that you described?
Okay, a death spiral, also known as a graveyard spiral, happens when the airplane starts to bank, and it banks past a certain point, as a bank gets steeper, wing lift is lost perpendicular to the ground because more and more of the lift is going into making the airplane turn.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is, as the plane continues to bank, because there's not enough lift keeping the airplane up in the air as opposed to turning, then the nose starts to drop and the airplane begins to descend. If a pilot sees that descent and tries to correct it by pulling back on the yoke, which is the steering wheel, that's the control. Pulling back on it is what would, in a normal flight, make you climb. Well, if you're in a substantial turn and you pull back on the yoke, it has the aerodynamic effect of steepening the turn and causing the nose to drop more.
Huh.
And so that causes the pilot to pull back harder, which causes the nose to drop more and the turn to steepen even more. And it doesn't take long to realize that what you've got is something on the order of a 5,000 to 6,000 foot per minute descent.
Wow, which is about what we're talking about with JFK's flight. And what you're talking about here is simply you've got to override your instinct to pull back.
Yes, there's a proper recovery from it, presuming you have enough altitude and you catch it in time, wherein you simply level the wings and then you pull out of the dive. Well, if you're lacking the visual references to know what wings level is, and you don't trust your instruments to be telling you correctly what wings level is, then obviously you can't execute the recovery correctly.
Our phone numbers are 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, or 1-800-242-2828, the toll-free line, as we're talking about small plane safety with Ken Ible, editor of Aviation Safety, here on Mid-Morning. I wanted to ask you, too, about some of the radar data that's coming in showing what happened with the Kennedy plane. And I think we're fairly certain this is, these statistics are correct. Radar records show Kennedy turned sharply away from Martha's Vineyard, then started dropping for about 5 minutes, then turned and climbed again, and then turned again and started diving at about 60 miles an hour. And this, they're saying, is evidence that he was disoriented. They're calling this what? It's called spatial disorientation?
Yes.
We've talked a little bit about that. Is it right to interpret the radar information as indicating that he might have been spatially disoriented?
Well, that's what seems to be the most likely candidate. There are some other scenarios that could that involve equipment malfunction that could explain some of this.
Mm-hmm.
Failure of his attitude indicator in a gradual way could have led him to chase, you know, to trust his instruments and chase it in the wrong direction, for example. You know, that may or may not be determined by examining the wreckage. You know, one factor that may, consideration is that the attitude indicator is powered by what is called a vacuum pump in the engine compartment. And a vacuum pump will typically, on a light plane, will typically last, you know, 500 to 1,000 hours. Mr. Kennedy's plane had somewhere just short of 600 hours on it. So it was in the time where, you know, perhaps a vacuum pump failure could have led the attitude indicator to give misleading information. Whether the wreckage will either, you know, show that it happened or even, you know, that we'll be able to tell is a guess at this point. But that's one way that a mechanical malfunction could have contributed to this crash. Going specifically with the spatial disorientation theory, when you get into a condition where you can't see the references outside, you know, your ear does play tricks on you. And although pilot training includes some exposure to those, to the unusual attitudes that you can get into, it's something that most people quickly forget. The fact remains that you can be perfectly upright and you think that you're banking all over the place, or you can be banking all over the place and think that you're perfectly upright. And there's really no way to know without checking your instruments or being able to see the horizon.
Now, people might think that it is just folks like John F. Kennedy Jr. who have, you know, pretty much unlimited money and prestige and ability, et cetera, have small planes. In fact, there was a big jump last year in the number of private pilot licenses that were issued. 616,000 were issued last year. That's up 13% from 1997. Small planes now can cost about, what, $100,000 or so, which is in the reach of a lot of people nowadays. There's a lot of disposable income around nowadays. What do you think about this trend in people getting, or more people getting certified for flying, and apparently more people buying planes?
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of people are feeling kind of put off by the airlines these days. But you certainly can't downplay the economic growth that we've had, the wealth that has been created by the stock market in recent years. You know, the $100,000 figure for an airplane is, you can get a pretty nice airplane for $100,000. You can get a basic airplane for, you know, $15,000 or $20,000. And a lot of people, what they will do is join up with one or two other people and buy an airplane in a partnership where they split all the costs two or three ways, and then just, you know, work out some sort of arrangement for who gets to fly it when, or...
Yeah, it's
or
a timeshare. Basically.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, and that works really well. It's not, yeah, there is the perception that it's a rich man's toy, especially when people start throwing out, you know, that the purchase price of a new Saratoga is, you know, can be up toward $500,000. But the used ones are certainly nowhere near that. And, you know, I think that I think it reflects people's desire to have some impact on what happens to them when they travel. You know, there's a large contingent of people that use them for business travel or personal travel. There's also a lot of people who just enjoy the sensation of flying, and they have simple airplanes that they take up in nice weather and, you know, just buzz around a little bit, or, you know, maybe they'll go to a nearby town for breakfast and fly back, or what have you. And,
is it too easy nowadays to fly, though?
I don't
worry about that at all. No,
I think that the regulatory environment and the air traffic control environment is actually making it a little more difficult, because there are so many requirements for you know, inspecting the airplane, maintaining it in a certain way, having your own skills tested periodically, doing the medical exams that are required. There are a lot of hoops to jump through, and you know, as the fatal accident record continues to decline over time, I think it shows that the industry, or the pilots as a whole, are doing a pretty good job of policing themselves. And also, you know, the FAA has a significant oversight as well.
Yeah, there's small plane fatal accidents are down 22% from 1988 to 1998. Now it's about 360 a year. Let's bring Norm into the conversation here from Minneapolis. Hello, Norm.
Yes, hi. Ken mentioned this very briefly there, but I just wanted you to elaborate on to obtain a VFR, private pilot license, you are required to demonstrate your ability to recover from unusual attitudes under the hood. And that's just my short comment.
Unusual attitudes under the hood, what does that mean?
That means, well, during the flight demonstration to obtain your private license, they put on the blinders, as you mentioned earlier, and just solely by reference to the instruments, you put your head down, and the examiner will put you into an unusual attitude, and then you'll lift your head, and just purely by looking at the instruments, you have to recover the aircraft.
And you have to do that even, and that's just for the
just for the
VFR.
Private pilot.
Just for the VFR?
For the VFR, yes.
Is that's true, Mr. Abel?
Yes, the rationale behind that is to try to give private pilots some sort of an out if they inadvertently fly into a cloud or get upset by you know, wake turbulence from a larger airplane or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The training and the recovery test that exist for the private pilot are it comes after the instructor or the examiner induces a little bit of disorientation to you just by maneuvering the airplane in a particular way. You can get a slight case of vertigo, and you kind of lose track of which direction you're pointing, and then you're expected to recover the airplane into more or less straight and level flight. I think that certainly helps pilots cope with an inadvertent encounter with the clouds or with some sort of an unusual situation. That is, however, significantly different than flying for a long time, you know, without having those references to the outside. Because as the lack of visual cues continues, the feelings of disorientation grow. And so while you might be able to do it for a short term, after this sensation is induced, it's I think a different matter to do it for a long period of time.
I've heard a figure of tossed around of something like 3 hours for instrument training. Is that any requirement?
That's the current statutory requirement. They change it from time to time, how much instrument training and how much night training is required. But that's the current figure.
And that's for who? For which
pilot?
That's
for a private pilot. That's for someone with a VFR rating only.
Okay, so that's for kind of a passing familiarity with using the instrument.
Yes. The theory is that, again, if you inadvertently get into the clouds, you can make a 180-degree turn and get back out into where you can see again.
Shouldn't that be more? 5 hours, 10 hours maybe, given the usefulness of it?
Well, with some pilots, I think 50 hours isn't enough. But no, seriously, you know, just the figure you put on it, you know, is admittedly fairly arbitrary. Should it be more? Well, you know, maybe or maybe not. I think it, what it does is it tries to give the private pilot some sort of exposure to what it's like if it happens. And that, you know, it may serve to scare people away so that their decisions then about weather are so conservative that it'll never happen to them. And other people, you know, it may say, well, gee, you know, this isn't so hard, I can go ahead and do this, even though they're not licensed to. I think it's sufficient for a private pilot with a VFR rating. That's sort of an entry-level rating, and it really helps get people into aviation, and a lot of people at that point find out that, you know, they don't really enjoy it anymore, or they don't get any usefulness out of it, and they don't really fly anymore. To add to those requirements for a VFR pilot, I think only unnecessarily adds cost to the rating and adds complication, and I just don't think that it would serve anything to increase that.
8 minutes before 10 o'clock, you're listening to Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. 651-227-6000, the number in the Twin Cities to get involved. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828 if you have questions or comments for Ken Eibold as we talk about small plane safety. Let's go to Fred on the line from Fargo. Fred, welcome to the show.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. I'm just wondering about this. There's a subtle over-sensationalization here coming from this 5,000 feet per second hitting the water, you know.
Per minute.
Per minute. Now that's, my God, that's 300,000 feet per hour. You know, why don't you just say 60 miles an hour?
I did.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of the media that uses
this figure now,
and I think it insults the intelligence of the people that are listening. You know, you don't immediately convert miles per hour into feet per minute. You know, and in fact, isn't that almost a stall speed for an airplane?
Okay,
maybe didn't he almost maybe take a quick dive? If he had engine failure, wouldn't that be an almost a stall speed and a survivable speed for a crash if he had succeeded?
Well, I think that that you need to distinguish between its descent rate, which is the figure of 5,000 feet per minute that they're quoting, and the aircraft's speed. Because the airplane was probably going at, this is admittedly wild speculation, it was probably doing about 200 knots at least. And its downward component of speed was that 60 miles an hour. So yes, the impact would be equivalent to you know, jumping off a building until you're, you know, and hitting the ground at 60 miles an hour, but the actual velocity of the airplane was much greater than that. I don't think that a stall scenario works simply because if it hit the water and if it was going straight down and hit the water at 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour, it would not have fragmented nearly as bad as it did.
I don't know how much of this is worth it because I don't know that I'd want to hit the water at 60 miles an hour or at 200 knots. Is 200 knots the forward speed and 60 miles an hour is the downward speed? Is that a good way to look at it? Is that even correct?
Well, the
I'm just trying to put it in layman's terms.
Yeah, the 200 miles an hour would be the speed that it's going in the direction that the nose is pointing.
Huh.
You know, part of that is down and part of it, you know, forward.
And we don't know which way the nose
We don't know which way that was.
Okay.
Once the, you know, it's possible that when the airspeed indicator, if it's recovered, will have some markings on it that will show what it was indicating at the time of impact, which will do a lot to determine whether, you know, he was going straight down at a relatively low speed or coming in at an angle at an extremely high speed.
Let's take another call. We've got Nick on the line from Duluth. Hi, Nick.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. My question or comment is about, have you heard about the Cirrus SR-20 plane that has the parachute? And what issues or what concerns you may have about general aviation and the impact of a plane like that?
Well, the Cirrus, has a ballistic recovery parachute system in which if the pilot determines that things are hopeless, I'm out of control, I'm going to crash, there's a red handle on the right built into the ceiling of the airplane where he pulls the lever, a parachute pops out and the airplane is lowered to the ground. It is designed that it will land bottom first, and the seats are designed to absorb as much of that impact as possible. Now, that, you know, that's a significant safety advance, but there are a few limitations. First of all, the pilot not only has to accept the fact that he's out of control and he's going to crash, but he actually has to then do something about it and yank the handle. A lot of pilots may feel the tendency to hang on just a few minutes longer. I think I can get this thing back until it's too late. There are also a lot of scenarios in which the crash would be at such a low altitude that, or that the event would be at such a low altitude that the parachute would not have time to deploy.
Well, and again, this is some speculation here, but if it was really hazy the way it was off Martha's Vineyard, right, would you even know that you were that close to the ground in order to pull your parachute at some point?
Yeah, you may not. You may not.
Let's take Tracy from Shoreview. Hi, Tracy. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, good morning. I understand the idea of trying to avoid excess regulation, but I'm concerned that there should be a change in regulation before people should be able to pilot passengers under the circumstances that a pilot may endanger himself, but the people flying with him aren't going to be able to appreciate what the true danger is.
Good question.
Well, that that limitation actually does exist. Part of the, before you get your private license, the private license is basically what allows you to carry passengers. Up to that point, as you're a student pilot, you do make several flights that, and in fact, I think 20 hours of solo flight are required. And what that does is that is an attempt to get you over the learning curve so that, under the theory that it's okay to kill yourself, but just don't take anybody innocent with you. And, you know, that's a good one because it give you a chance to, you know, make your own decisions and make your own mistakes without the pressure of having, you know, the wife aboard or the husband aboard or the friend aboard, you know, with the added pressure to get to your destination or to you know, show off for them and show how good you are or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. Just a half minute left. I wanted to ask you if folks in the general aviation world are concerned that because this is such a high-profile crash that Congress or somebody else is going to react and slap more regulations.
I think it's a distinct possibility.
Really?
Whether, you know, in the sense that, you know, perhaps the parachutes that were mentioned earlier may be required on all new planes or something like that. You know, that's always a possibility. You know, is it a fear? Well, you know, regulation is seems to be the fear of every industry, so I guess that does exist too.
Thank you very much for your time this morning.
My pleasure.
Ken Eibold, editor of Aviation Safety, a monthly newsletter, and thanks very much to everybody who called in this hour of mid-morning.